This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
it's where there have been some 1,500 migrants living there in tents. Most of the migrants there have come from Sudan, Somalia, or Eritrea and have arrived in France from Italy before that they had crossed from Libya across the Mediterranean.
That's reporter Catherine Field in France. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, UNICEF is warning that hundreds of thousands of children in Mali are at risk of dying of severe malnutrition.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, it's officially election season for Zimbabwe today. President Emmerson Mnangagwa set the date for national elections to select a president, members of parliament, and other officials. Reporter Kuzaiza Nawash has more.
A government gazette released Wednesday says the election will be held July 30th. Tendai Biti is the president of the People's Democratic Party and part of the MDC alliance, made up of several parties determined to defeat the ruling ZANU-PF in the election.
Well, you can see from the work we've been doing on the ground, the massive rallies that we've been doing on the quantitative level, we are ready for an election. But you can also see that at the technical level, the country is not ready for an election.
Biti says a lot needs to happen before the elections.
This man called Emmerson has just called for an election. But the voters' roll, the inspection only ended yesterday, and the voters' roll is not available to Zimbabweans. For political parties, it is so key. The nomination court will be in 14 days' time, yet we don't have the voters' roll, and you can only be nominated by people that are on the voters' roll.
He adds that the opposition will turn to the courts to pressure the responsible authorities to level the playing field. Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and other political events. He welcomes the announcement of the election date, but has reservations about how prepared opposition parties are for the vote.
I think it's a good thing that at least now we have a date to work towards. I do think that it's unfortunate that our opposition parties are still in disarray, two MDCTs banning parallel structures, visible confusion. And I do think that anything outside of a united opposition will definitely lose to ZANU-PF. And it's unfortunate that the opposition only has 8 weeks now to come together.
Dodo adds the opposition's campaigns have not been very effective. They have relied on rallies, whereas ZANU-PF uses a wide array of media. Political analysts say this election will be one of the most significant votes in decades. It will be the first time Robert Mugabe is not on the ballot paper, having been ousted by the military last year. And the opposition will be missing its long-time leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who died earlier this year. While many Zimbabweans may be looking forward to the election, those living overseas will remain onlookers. Wednesday, the Constitutional Court rejected a suit seeking to grant the vote to those in the diaspora. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
French police evacuated approximately 1,000 migrants this morning from the largest of three makeshift migrant camps in northern Paris. The camp known as the Millionaire or Millennium Camp was home to mostly Sudanese, Somali, and Eritrean migrants. Police say within a week they will clear two smaller camps further along the canal where some 400 to 500 mostly Afghan migrants are living. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me about the process of moving the migrants and how a new immigration law could affect the future of migrants in Paris.
Yes, it was at dawn that security forces came through the camps. It's become known as the Millennium Camp, which is in the northeast of Paris. It's essentially a shanty town of tents, of lean-tos, underneath the overpasses, the bridges in the northeast of Paris and alongside the canal. It's where there have been some 1,500 migrants living there in tents. Most of the migrants there have come from Sudan, Somalia, or Eritrea and have arrived in France from Italy before that they had crossed from Libya across the Mediterranean. French authorities have moved them to different sites across the Paris region. Some have been taken to gymnasiums, others to school halls where beds have been made available for them. In the course of Wednesday, their IDs will be checked, their immigration status will be checked. And then between now and the end of this week, their papers will be going through. The authorities will be looking to see who qualifies to apply for refugee status or asylum status. And also, they will be checking thoroughly to see if any of those who have been taken in today have already registered in other European countries. The French authorities say they will be sent back immediately to those other countries where they have initially applied for either refugee or asylum status.
And so far, I guess about 1,000 have already been moved, and there's still more to be moved.
Yes, they've moved around 900 men, 11 unaccompanied minors, and 87 women and children. There's still at least another 1,000 who will be moved sometime within the next week. They are being left where they are for now because this whole process just takes so many security forces and it also takes so many bureaucrats to go through the paperwork. The other two camps are further towards the center of Paris along the canal. There are several hundred migrants from Afghanistan. They are said to have come from Germany, Sweden, and Austria, where they had originally applied for refugee status. They will be moved sometime within the next week. It really does show that, once again, the Paris authorities have been unable to cope with these arrivals. There's been this big argument between the Paris town hall and the central government over who is responsible for these migrants. The Paris town hall says it's the state, and the state is saying, look, you've allowed these camps to spring up in Paris, you've actually got to look after it. Certainly, from the state's point of view, this is the 35th evacuation that they've done in the last 3 years. These evacuations are becoming bigger and, of course, more frequent. And they say that if the Paris authorities hadn't moved these people on very quickly, then this is what's going to happen again and again and again. On the other side, though, the NGOs and the Paris town hall are saying, look, unless there is a system across France of sort of special pre-reception centres, then these migrants are going to keep coming back and they're going to look for anywhere that they can pitch their tent.
What is President Macron saying about the situation at this point?
President Macron has got his eye very clearly on this new migration law that is now going through the upper house of parliament. It's been through the lower house already, and his new law will speed up the asylum process, but it will also increase the deportations. What he's clearly saying is that if you have a right to refugee or asylum status in France, we're going to get your paperwork done quicker because of this new law once it goes through parliament. Likewise, if you're only here for a job, looking for an economic benefit, then you're going to be home again much quicker.
That was Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris.
A former Ebola patient in the Democratic Republic of the Congo has been cured of the illness and released from hospital. Wangui Nondisi's release comes about 2 weeks after he was admitted to a hospital in Bikoro in Equator province. The aid group Doctors Without Borders says it has started vaccinating frontline workers in the area as well as those who have come in contact with infected patients. Doctors say this strategy will help build a ring or buffer to block the spread of Ebola. Doctors Without Borders has set up 2 treatment centers in Bikoro where there are at least 10 confirmed patients and a dozen others suspected to have the illness. The aid group is also working in the remote areas of Itipo and Iboko. Those suspected of infection by Ebola are kept in isolation in Itipo. An isolation area and treatment center are also being established in Iboko.
UNICEF is warning that hundreds of thousands of severely malnourished children in Mali are at risk of dying as the security situation in the country worsens. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations reports that attacks by extremists and criminals in northern and central Mali are rising at an alarming rate, with many civilians being deliberately targeted. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says more than a million children are going hungry because of severe food shortages.
More than 850,000 children under the age of five are at risk of global acute malnutrition this year, including 274,000 children facing severe malnutrition and at imminent risk of death. This represents a 34% increase, and it's largely due to the worsening food security situation in parts of the country.
The UN reports 20% of the country is suffering from food insecurity and 1.2 million people lack water, sanitation, and basic hygiene. UNICEF says severe acute malnutrition rates are highest in the conflict-affected areas in the north, exceeding the emergency level of 15% in Timbuktu. It cites Mali as one of the countries with the highest newborn and maternal mortality rates in the world. Bouyrak also says newborn deaths are rising because of malnutrition and lack of basic health services. Northern Mali has been in turmoil since 2012 when Islamist militant groups temporarily seized control of the region. On a visit to Mali's capital, Bamako, on Tuesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres paid homage to the UN peacekeepers who have been killed while serving in what is considered the world body's most dangerous peacekeeping mission. 21 peacekeepers were killed in attacks by extremists last year. While in Mali, Guterres appealed for funds to support the G5 Sahel force, which is composed of troops from Mali, Niger, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania. The force was created to contain the West African jihadists active in Mali and nearby countries. UNICEF calls the crisis in Mali one of the most forgotten in the world. It notes nearly 80% of the agency's $37 million humanitarian appeal for this year remains unfunded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
17 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Tunisia held elections in 350 municipalities earlier this month. Observers say they were a crucial step in the country's effort to empower towns and engage citizens, but they were also only one small piece of a much larger decentralization program whose fate is uncertain. Some warn that elections will be meaningless without a strong legal framework for decentralization and the political will to implement reforms at both the national and local levels. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi has the story.
Since the 2011 revolution, Tunisia has taken several steps to devolve power from the highly centralized structures run by the Ben Ali family to the new democratic central government and then from the executive to the parliament. This decentralization of power has the potential to address dramatic regional disparities in healthcare and education, as well as in poverty and infrastructure. By empowering local actors and improving service delivery, the decentralization effort could enhance public confidence in the government. Marwan Maasher is Vice President of Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on North Africa and the Middle East.
Decentralization does have a potential to empower Tunisians to make decisions and help address the massive trust gap between the people and the government, which has been steadily growing. There's a growing perception in Tunisia that democracy is no longer sufficient and people are expecting results.
Maasher says, if done right, decentralization will empower local actors to make decisions regarding their municipalities and regions that lead to real change for their constituents. This also could introduce a new political class. It would be outside the country's traditionally dominant political parties and could provide more opportunities for women and youth to enter politics. Intisar Khareji is a Tunisian-British researcher. She is the program director at the Jasmine Foundation, a Tunisian think tank. She says decentralization should also improve service delivery at the local level, where poor performance since the 2011 revolution has resulted in mistrust between citizens and the state, as well as low tax revenues. However, she says there are requirements for a successful decentralization process.
What's needed is, first of all, political will at the central level to decentralize. And the second thing is really financing. And at the moment, municipal councils have very small resources. At the moment, it's only 4% of public funds go to municipalities, and that will enable them to have more local projects that actually, you know, drive development and drive job creation.
Khareji says the national government should also provide adequate human resources and experts to enhance the ability of the new over 7,000 elected local officials to deliver. Sarah Yerkes is a Tunisia expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She says the country currently suffers from dramatic regional disparities. 18 municipalities, including the capital city of Tunis and its suburbs, hold 51% of the state's municipal budget, while 246 municipalities hold the remaining 49%. Citizens in Tunisia's traditionally marginalized regions hope that decentralization will bring more attention to their regions, especially job creation.
Decentralization can help address job creation and some of the economic challenges by being a more effective and efficient use of resources, by actually spending resources at the local level where they're needed.
She says reforms can benefit particular young people, especially those with degrees in management or policy, who can take on new roles as local bureaucrats. The Carnegie expert says while both local and national government officials and institutions must work together to make decentralization a reality, the national government's political will is the most critical factor for its success. Meanwhile, Western donors say they are ready to help provide funds for local councils to start projects, and they and the International Monetary Fund are helping to reduce large budget deficits that have accumulated over years of political and economic uncertainty. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Kenyan Youth Affairs Principal Secretary Lillian Amalo, who has been charged in the massive corruption case at the National Youth Service, was admitted to a hospital today after falling ill in prison. Amalo apparently complained of dizziness and was trembling, but no details on her condition have been released. She is among 24 government officials and business people arrested yesterday. Prosecutors allege that officials at the National Youth Service colluded with business owners and others to divert as much as $100 million in funding to private accounts. Amalo is among the highest-ranking Kenyan official ever implicated in a corruption case.
Angola's new president, João Lourenço, has had a surprisingly combative relationship with the man he replaced. When Lourenço took office last September, former president José Eduardo dos Santos retained leadership of the ruling MPLA party. The result is what Angolan analysts describe as a bicephaly, a body with two heads and plenty of tension between the two. But bicephaly may be coming to an end. From Boston, Luis Costa Ribas reports.
When Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos announced in 2016 that he would not seek another term, his allies and opponents were skeptical. Dos Santos had been in power for 38 years. He had previously indicated his intention to retire, only to change his mind and fire those who showed any interest in replacing him. This time, he promised to retire from active politics in 2018 and introduced his successor, Defense Minister João Lourenço. Lourenço was elected in 2017, but Dos Santos held on to his post as party leader. And while Dos Santos made clear he preferred continuity, Lourenço wanted change. Tension between the two began almost immediately. Victor Silva is the editor-in-chief of Jornal de Angola, a state-owned daily seen as aligned with the government.
Esse curto-circuito resultou essencialmente da velocidade com que as mudanças, as reformas.
Silva says that short circuit was mainly due to the speedy implementation of reforms by João Lourenço. He also says that has affected the interests of groups created during the Dos Santos administration to the point that some party elders began to worry and have been urging Dos Santos not to step down as party leader so he can defend their interests. Lourenço came in vowing to fight corruption and increase government accountability. He has fired Dos Santos' relatives from lucrative state positions and severed most of their business ties with the government. Rui Neumann is an African analyst in Paris. He says those moves threaten Dos Santos.
Il a craigné une sortie du pouvoir comme ça arrivait à plusieurs leaders africains.
Neumann says Dos Santos created an exit from office like many other African leaders who cling to power. Before his departure, he had a law passed designed to protect his closest friends and his family. The new president is not changing the law, but he wants to speed up Dos Santos's full departure. Silver predicts that will come soon, now that the MPLA Political Bureau has scheduled a special congress for the first half of September and chose Lourenço as its candidate to lead the party.
A questão da bicefalia vai ser esbatida com a assunção da liderança do partido por parte.
Silva says the question of bicephaly will be solved when João Lourenço takes over the party leadership. He thinks the fact that Lourenço was chosen by the Political Bureau to be its candidate gives him enough political backing to firmly hold the reins of power. Silva also thinks that under the Angolan political system, the president's powers must work along with the MPLA presidency to address voter concerns. Rui Neumann, who said he thought bicephaly was overrated, thinks João Lourenço will win this political arm wrestling because he holds the reins of real power, the presidency. Lourenço recently replaced more than 20 senior security officials, including the Armed Forces Chief of Staff, the police commander, and the heads of foreign and domestic intelligence.
Il peut avoir toujours des chocs, ça veut dire le clan José Eduardo Sánchez a essayé toujours à tout prix.
Neumann says collisions may happen between the José Eduardo dos Santos clan, which will try to hold on to power, and João Lourenço, who is assembling his own Praetorian Guard with heavy weights from the Political Bureau and the military. Those collisions are less likely now that the Political Bureau has picked Lourenço as its candidate for party leader, but they're not impossible. One of Mr. dos Santos' daughters, Velvicia dos Santos, known as Chizé, is a member of parliament. She defends having a divided leadership with her father as head of the party to prevent the current president from persecuting those loyal to her father.
Vamos ficar à mercê de que qualquer presidente da República que nós elejamos passa a decidir perseguir ou.
Chizé dos Santos asks, are we going to be at the mercy of any given president we elect, who may decide to persecute or not to impede persecution, or who may decide to incite hatred against certain people? She continues by saying that different people holding the reins of government and the ruling party will prevent the president from having absolute power. Ms. Dos Santos says she is ready to run for a position in the party leadership and has complained of persecution from President Lourenço's government. Luis Costa Rivas, VOA, Boston.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, is it the dawn of a new era in Ethiopian politics, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is promising to strengthen democratic reforms and promote unity in the East African nation. Moving forward in Ethiopia on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.